Chapter 1. _ Childhood _. In Talbot County, Eastern Shore, Maryland, near Easton, the county town of that county, there is a small district of country, thinly populated, and remarkable for nothing that I know of more than for the worn-out, sandy, desert-like appearance of its soil, the general dilapidation of its farms and fences, the indigent and spiritless character of its inhabitants, and the prevalence of ague and fever. The name of this singularly unpromising and truly famine-stricken district is Tuckahoe, a name well known to all Marylanders, black and white. It was given to this section of country probably, at the first, merely in derision, or it may possibly have been applied to it, as I have heard, because some one of its earlier inhabitants had been guilty of the petty meanness of stealing a hoe or taking a hoe that did not belong to him. Eastern Shore men usually pronounce the word _took_, as _tuck, took a hoe _, therefore, is, in Maryland parlance, _Tuckahoe _. But, whatever may have been its origin and about this I will not be, 26, positive that name has stuck to the district in question, and it is seldom mentioned but with contempt and derision, on account of the barrenness of its soil, and the ignorance, indolence, and poverty of its people. Decay and ruin are everywhere visible, and the thin population of the place would have quitted it long ago, but for the Choptank River, which runs through it, from which they take abundance of shad and herring, and plenty of ague and fever. It was in this dull, flat, and unthrifty district, or neighborhood, surrounded by a white population of the lowest order, indolent and drunken to a proverb, and among slaves, who seemed to ask, what's the use? Every time they lifted a hoe, that I without any fault of mine was born, and spent the first years of my childhood. The reader will pardon so much about the place of my birth, on the score that it is always a fact of some importance to know where a man is born. If, indeed, it be important to know anything about him. In regard to the _time_ of my birth, I cannot be as definite as I have been respecting the _place_. Nor, indeed, can I impart much knowledge concerning my parents. Genealogical trees do not flourish among slaves. A person of some consequence here in the North, sometimes designated _father_, is literally abolished in slave law and slave practice. It is only once in a while that an exception is found to this statement. I never met with a slave who could tell me how old he was. Few slave mothers know anything of the months of the year, nor of the days of the month. They keep no family records, with marriages, births, and deaths. They measure the ages of their children by spring time, winter time, harvest time, planting time, and the like, but these soon become undistinguishable and forgotten. Like other slaves, I cannot tell how old I am. This destitution was among my earliest troubles. I learned when I grew up, that my master, and this is the case with masters generally, allowed no questions to be put to him, by which a slave might learn his 27 grandparents' age. Such questions deemed evidence of impatience, and even of impudent curiosity. From certain events, however, the dates of which I have since learned, I suppose myself to have been born about the year 1817. The first experience of life with me that I now remember, and I remember it but hazily, began in the family of my grandmother and grandfather, Betsy and Isaac Bailey. They were quite advanced in life, and had long lived on the spot where they then resided. They were considered old settlers in the neighborhood, and, from certain circumstances, I infer that my grandmother, especially, was held in high esteem, far higher than is the lot of most colored persons in the slave states. She was a good nurse, and a capital hand at making nets for catching shad and herring, and these nets were in great demand, not only in Tuckahoe, but at Denton and Hillsboro, neighboring villages. She was not only good at making the nets, but was also somewhat famous for her good fortune in taking the fishes referred to. I have known her to be in the water half the day. Grandmother was likewise more provident than most of her neighbors in the preservation of seedling sweet potatoes, and it happened to her as it will happen to any careful and thrifty person residing in an ignorant and improvident community to enjoy the reputation of having been born to good luck. Her good luck was owing to the exceeding care which she took in preventing the succulent root from getting bruised in the digging, and in placing it beyond the reach of frost, by actually burying it under the hearth of her cabin during the winter months. In the time of planting sweet potatoes, Grandmother Betty, as she was familiarly called, was sent for in all directions, simply to place the seedling potatoes in the hills, for superstition had it, that if Grandmama Betty but touches them at planting, they will be sure to grow and flourish. This high reputation was full of advantage to her, and to the children around her. Though Tuckahoe had but few of the good things of 28, life, yet of such as it did possess, Grandmother got a full share, in the way of presents. If good potato crops came after her planting, She was not forgotten by those for whom she planted, and as she was remembered by others, so she remembered the hungry little ones around her. The dwelling of my grandmother and grandfather had few pretensions. It was a log hut, or cabin, built of clay, wood, and straw. At a distance it resembled, though it was smaller, less commodious and less substantial, the cabins erected in the western states by the first settlers. To my child's eye, however, it was a noble structure, admirably adapted to promote the comforts and conveniences of its inmates. A few rough, Virginia fence rails, flung loosely over the rafters above, answered the triple purpose of floors, ceilings, and bedsteads. To be sure, this upper apartment was reached only by a ladder, but what in the world for climbing could be better than a ladder? To me, this ladder was really a high invention, and possessed a sort of charm as I played with delight upon the rounds of it. In this little hut there was a large family of children, I dare not say how many. My grandmother, whether because too old for field service, or because she had so faithfully discharged the duties of her station in early life, I know not, enjoyed the high privilege of living in a cabin, separate from the quarter, with no other burden than her own support, and the necessary care of the little children, imposed. She evidently esteemed it a great fortune to live so. The children were not her own, but her grandchildren the children of her daughters. She took delight in having them around her, and in attending to their few wants. The practice of separating children from their mother, and hiring the latter out at distances too great to admit of their meeting, except at long intervals, is a marked feature of the cruelty and barbarity of the slave system. But it is in harmony with the grand aim of slavery, which, always and everywhere, is to reduce man to a level with the brute. It is a successful method of obliterating 29 old master, from the mind and heart of the slave, all just ideas of the sacredness of the family as an institution. Most of the children, however, in this instance, being the children of my grandmother's daughters, the notions of family, and the reciprocal duties and benefits of the relation, had a better chance of being understood than where children are placed as they often are in the hands of strangers, who have no care for them, apart from the wishes of their masters. The daughters of my grandmother were five in number. Their names were Jenny, Esther, Millie, Priscilla, and Harriet. The daughter last named was my mother, of whom the reader shall learn more by and by. Living here, with my dear old grandmother and grandfather, it was a long time before I knew myself to be a slave underscore. I knew many other things before I knew that. Grandmother and grandfather were the greatest people in the world to me, and being with them so snugly in their own little cabin, I supposed it be their own, knowing no higher authority over me or the other children than the authority of grandmama. For a time there was nothing to disturb me, but, as I grew larger and older, I learned by degrees the sad fact, that the little hut, and the lot on which it stood, belonged not to my dear old grandparents, but to some person who lived a great distance off, and who was called, by grandmother, old master. I further learned the sadder fact, that not only the house and lot, but that grandmother herself, grandfather was free, and all the little children around her, belonged to this mysterious personage, called by grandmother, with every mark of reverence, old master. Thus early did clouds and shadows begin to fall upon my path. Once on the track, troubles never come singly. I was not long in finding out another fact, still more grievous to my childish heart. I was told that this old master, whose name seemed ever to be mentioned with fear and shuddering, only allowed the children to live with grandmother for a limited time, and that in fact as soon 30, as they were big enough, they were promptly taken away, to live with the said old master. These were distressing revelations indeed, and though I was quite too young to comprehend the full import of the intelligence, and mostly spent my childhood days in gleesome sports with the other children, a shade of disquiet rested upon me. The absolute power of this distant old master had touched my young spirit with but the point of its cold, cruel iron, and left me something to brood over after the play and in moments of repose. Grandmommy was, indeed, at that time, all the world to me, and the thought of being separated from her, in any considerable time, was more than an unwelcome intruder. It was intolerable. Children have their sorrows as well as men and women, and it would be well to remember this in our dealings with them. Slave children are children, and prove no exceptions to the general rule. The liability to be separated from my grandmother, seldom or never to see her again, haunted me. I dreaded the thought of going to live with that mysterious old master, whose name I never heard mentioned with affection, but always with fear. I look back to this as among the heaviest of my childhood sorrows. My grandmother. And the little hut, and the joyous circle under her care, but especially she, who made us sorry when she left us but for an hour, and glad on her return, how could I leave her in the good old home? But the sorrows of childhood, like the pleasures of afterlife, are transient. It is not even within the power of slavery to write underscore indelible underscore sorrow, at a single dash, over the heart of a child. Underscore the tear down childhood's cheek that flows, is like the dewdrop on the rose when next the summer breeze comes by, and waves the bush the flower is dry underscore. There is, after all, but little difference in the measure of contentment felt by the slave child neglected and the slaveholder's 31 comparative happiness, child cared for and petted. The spirit of the all just mercifully holds the balance for the young. The slaveholder, having nothing to fear from impotent childhood, easily affords to refrain from cruel inflictions, and if cold and hunger do not pierce the tender frame, the first 7 or 8 years of the slave boy's life are about as full of sweet content as those of the most favored and petted underscore white underscore children of the slaveholder. The slave boy escapes many troubles which befall and vex his white brother. He seldom has to listen to lectures on propriety of behavior, or on anything else. He is never chided for handling his little knife and fork improperly or awkwardly, for he uses none. He is never reprimanded for soiling the tablecloth, for he takes his meals on the clay floor. He never has the misfortune, in his games or sports, of soiling or tearing his clothes, for he is almost none to soil or tear. He is never expected to act like a nice little gentleman, for he is only a rude little slave. Thus, freed from all restraint, the slave boy can be, in his life and conduct, a genuine boy, doing whatever his boyish nature suggests, enacting, by turns, all the strange antics and freaks of horses, dogs, pigs, and barn door fowls, without in any manner compromising his dignity, or incurring reproach of any sort. He literally runs wild, has no pretty little verses to learn in the nursery, no nice little speeches to make for aunts, uncles, or cousins, to show how smart he is, and, if he can only manage to keep out of the way of the heavy feet and fists of the older slave boys, he may trot on, in his joyous and roguish tricks, as happy as any little heathen under the palm trees of Africa. To be sure, he is occasionally reminded, when he stumbles in the path of his master and this he early learns to avoid that he is eating his underscore white bread, underscore and that he will be made to underscore see sights underscore by and by. The threat is soon forgotten, the shadow soon passes, and our sable boy continues to roll in the dust, or play in the mud, as best suits him, and in the veriest freedom. If he feels uncomfortable, from mud or from dust, the coast is clear, he can plunge into 32, the river or the pond, without the ceremony of undressing, or the fear of wetting his clothes, his little tow linen shirt for that is all he has on is easily dried, and it needed ablution as much as did his skin. His food is of the coarsest kind, consisting for the most part of cornmeal mush, which often finds its way from the wooden tray to his mouth in an oyster shell. His days, when the weather is warm, are spent in the pure, open air, and in the bright sunshine. He always sleeps in airy apartments, he seldom has to take powders, or to be paid to swallow pretty little sugar-coated pills, to cleanse his blood, or to quicken his appetite. He eats no candies, gets no lumps of loaf sugar, always relishes his food, cries but little, for nobody cares for his crying, learns to esteem his bruises but slight, because others so esteem them. In a word, he is, for the most part of the first 8 years of his life, a spirited, joyous, uproarious, and happy boy, upon whom troubles fall only like water on a duck's back. And such a boy, so far as I can now remember, was the boy whose life in slavery I am now narrating. Chapter 2. Underscore removed from my first home underscore. That mysterious individual referred to in the first chapter as an object of terror among the inhabitants of our little cabin, under the ominous title of Old Master, was really a man of some consequence. He owned several farms in Tuckahoe, was the chief clerk and butler on the home plantation of Colonel Edward Lloyd, had overseers on his own farms, and gave directions to overseers on the farms belonging to Colonel Lloyd. This plantation is situated on Wye River, the river receiving its name, doubtless, from Wales, where the Lloyds originated. They, the Lloyds, are an old and honored family in Maryland, exceedingly wealthy. The home plantation, where they have resided, perhaps for a century or more, is one of the largest, most fertile, and best appointed, in the state. About this plantation, and about that queer old master who must be something more than a man, and something worse than an angel, the reader will easily imagine that I was not only curious, but eager, to know all that could be known. Unhappily for me, however, all the information I could get concerning him increased my great dread of being carried thither, of being 34, separated from and deprived of the protection of my grandmother and grandfather. It was, evidently, a great thing to go to Colonel Lloyd's, and I was not without a little curiosity to see the place, but no amount of coaxing could induce in me the wish to remain there. The fact is, such was my dread of leaving the little cabin, that I wished to remain little forever, For I knew the taller I grew, the shorter my stay. The old cabin, with its rail floor and rail bedsteads upstairs, and its clay floor downstairs, and its dirt chimney, and windowless sides, and that most curious piece of workmanship dug in front of the fireplace, beneath which Grandmommy placed the sweet potatoes to keep them from the frost, was my home, the only home I ever had, and I loved it, and all connected with it. The old fences around it, and the stumps in the edge of the woods near it, and the squirrels that ran, skipped, and played upon them, were objects of interest and affection. There, too, right at the side of the hut, stood the old well, with its stately and skyward pointing beam, so aptly placed between the limbs of what had once been a tree, and so nicely balanced that I could move it up and down with only one hand, and could get a drink myself without calling for help. Where else in the world could such a well be found, and where could such another home be met with? Nor were these all the attractions of the place. Down in a little valley, not far from Grandmommy's cabin, stood Mr. Lee's mill, where the people came often in large numbers to get their corn ground. It was a water mill, and I never shall be able to tell them anything thought and felt, while I sat on the bank and watched that mill, and the turning of that ponderous wheel. The mill pond, too, had its charms, and with my pinhook, and thread line, I could get _nibbles_, if I could catch no fish. But, in all my sports and plays, and in spite of them, there would, occasionally, come the painful foreboding that I was not long to remain there, and that I must soon be called away to the home of old master. I was a slave born a slave, and though the fact was in 35 departure from Tuckahoe, comprehensible to me, it conveyed to my mind a sense of my entire dependence on the will of _somebody_ I had never seen, and, from some cause or other, I had been made to fear this somebody above all else on earth. Born for another's benefit, as the _firstling_ of the cabin flock, I was soon to be selected as a meat offering to the fearful and inexorable _demigod_, whose huge image on so many occasions haunted my childhood's imagination. When the time of my departure was decided upon, my grandmother, knowing my fears, and in pity for them, kindly kept me ignorant of the dreaded event about to transpire. Up to the morning, a beautiful summer morning, when we were to start, and, indeed, during the whole journey, a journey which, child as I was, I remember as well as if it were yesterday, she kept the sad fact hidden from me. This reserve was necessary, for, could I have known all, I should have given grandmother some trouble in getting me started. As it was, I was helpless, and she, dear woman, led me along by the hand, resisting, with the reserve and solemnity of a priestess, all my inquiring looks to the last. The distance from Tuckahoe to Wye River, where my old master lived, was full 12 miles, and the walk was quite a severe test of the endurance of my young legs. The journey would have proved too severe for me, but that my dear old grandmother, blessings on her memory, afforded occasional relief by toting me, as Marylanders have it, on her shoulder. My grandmother, though advanced in years, as was evident from more than one gray hair, which peeped from between the ample and graceful folds of her newly ironed bandana turban, was yet a woman of power and spirit. She was marvelously straight in figure, elastic, and muscular. I seemed hardly to be a burden to her. She would have toted me farther, but that I felt myself too much of a man to allow it, and insisted on walking. Releasing dear grandmama from carrying me, did not make me altogether independent of her. When we happened to pass through portions of the somber woods which lay between Tuckahoe and 36, Wye River, she often found me increasing the energy of my grip, and holding her clothing, lest something should come out of the woods and eat me up. Several old logs and stumps imposed upon me, and got themselves taken for wild beasts. I could see their legs, eyes, and ears, or I could see something like eyes, legs, and ears, till I got close enough to them to see that the eyes were knots, washed white with rain, and the legs were broken limbs, and the ears, only ears owing to the point from which they were seen. Thus early I learned that the point from which a thing is viewed is of some importance. As the day advanced, the heat increased, and it was not until the afternoon that we reached the much dreaded end of the journey. I found myself in the midst of a group of children of many colors, black, brown, copper-colored, and nearly white. I had not seen so many children before. Great houses loomed up in different directions, and a great many men and women were at work in the fields. All this hurry, noise, and singing was very different from the stillness of Tuckahoe. As a newcomer, I was an object of special interest, and, after laughing and yelling around me, and playing all sorts of wild tricks, they, the children, asked me to go out and play with them. This I refused to do, preferring to stay with Grandmama. I could not help feeling that our being there boded no good to me. Grandmama looked sad. She was soon to lose another object of affection, as she had lost many before. I knew she was unhappy, and the shadow fell from her brow on me, though I knew not the cause. All suspense, however, must have an end, and the end of mine, in this instance, was at hand. Affectionately patting me on the head, and exhorting me to be a good boy, Grandmama told me to go and play with the little children. "They are kin to you," said she, "go and play with them." Among a number of cousins were Phil, Tom, Steve, and Jerry, Nance and Betty. Grandmother pointed out my brother Perry, my sister Sarah, and my sister Eliza, who stood in the group. I had never seen 37 brothers and sisters, my brother nor my sisters before, and, though I had sometimes heard of them, and felt a curious interest in them, I really did not understand what they were to me, or I to them. We were brothers and sisters, but what of that? Why should they be attached to me, or I to them? Brothers and sisters we were by blood, but _slavery_ had made us strangers. I heard the words brother and sisters, and knew they must mean something, but slavery had robbed these terms of their true meaning. The experience through which I was passing, they had passed through before. They had already been initiated into the mysteries of old master's domicile, and they seemed to look upon me with a certain degree of compassion, but my heart clave to my grandmother. Think it not strange, dear reader, that so little sympathy of feeling existed between us. The conditions of brotherly and sisterly feeling were wanting. We had never nestled and played together. My poor mother, like many other slave women, had many children, but no family. The domestic hearth, with its holy lessons and precious endearments, is abolished in the case of a slave mother and her children. "Little children, love one another," are words seldom heard in a slave cabin. I really wanted to play with my brother and sisters, but they were strangers to me, and I was full of fear that grandmother might leave without taking me with her. Entreated to do so, however, and that, too, by my dear grandmother, I went to the back part of the house, to play with them and the other children. _play_, however, I did not, but stood with my back against the wall, witnessing the playing of the others. At last, while standing there, one of the children, who had been in the kitchen, ran up to me, in a sort of roguish glee, exclaiming, "Fed, fed! Grandmommy gone! Grandmommy gone!" I could not believe it, yet, fearing the worst, I ran into the kitchen, to see for myself, and found it even so. Grandmommy had indeed gone, and was now far away, clean out of sight. I need not tell all that happened now. Almost heartbroken at the discovery, I fell upon the ground, and 38, wept a boy's bitter tears, refusing to be comforted. My brother and sisters came around me, and said, "Don't cry," and gave me peaches and pears, but I flung them away, and refused all their kindly advances. I had never been deceived before, and I felt not only grieved at parting as I supposed forever with my grandmother, but indignant that a trick had been played upon me in a matter so serious. It was now late in the afternoon. The day had been an exciting and wearisome one, and I knew not how or where, but I suppose I sobbed myself to sleep. There is a healing in the angel wing of sleep, even for the slave boy, and its balm was never more welcome to any wounded soul than it was to mine, the first night I spent at the domicile of old master. The reader may be surprised that I narrate so minutely an incident apparently so trivial, and which must have occurred when I was not more than 7 years old. But as I wish to give a faithful history of my experience in slavery, I cannot withhold a circumstance which, at the time, affected me so deeply. Besides, this was, in fact, my first introduction to the realities of slavery. Chapter 3. _parentage_. If the reader will now be kind enough to allow me time to grow bigger, and afford me an opportunity for my experience to become greater, I will tell him something, by and by, of slave life, as I saw, felt, and heard it, on Colonel Edward Lloyd's plantation, and at the house of old master, where I had now, despite of myself, most suddenly, but not unexpectedly, been dropped. Meanwhile, I will redeem my promise to say something more of my dear mother. I say nothing of _father_, for he is shrouded in a mystery I have never been able to penetrate. Slavery does away with fathers, as it does away with families. Slavery has no use for either fathers or families, and its laws do not recognize their existence in the social arrangements of the plantation. When they exist, they are not the outgrowths of slavery, but are antagonistic to that system. The order of civilization is reversed here. The name of the child is not expected to be that of its father, and his condition does not necessarily affect that of the child. He may be the slave of Mr. Tilghman, and his child, when born, may be the slave of Mr. Gross. He may be a _freeman _, and yet his child may be a _chattel_. He may be white, glorying in the purity of his Anglo-Saxon 40, blood, and his child may be ranked with the blackest slaves. Indeed, he underscore may underscore be, and often underscore is underscore, master and father to the same child. He can be father without being a husband, and may sell his child without incurring reproach, if the child be by a woman in whose veins courses 1/32nd part of African blood. My father was a white man, or nearly white. It was sometimes whispered that my master was my father. But to return, or rather, to begin. My knowledge of my mother is very scanty, but very distinct. Her personal appearance and bearing are ineffaceably stamped upon my memory. She was tall, and finely proportioned, of deep black, glossy complexion, had regular features, and, among the other slaves, was remarkably sedate in her manners. There is an underscore Pritchard's Natural History of Man underscore, the head of a figure on page 157, the features of which so resemble those of my mother, that I often recur to it with something of the feeling which I suppose others experience when looking upon the pictures of dear departed ones. Yet I cannot say that I was very deeply attached to my mother, certainly not so deeply as I should have been had our relations in childhood been different. We were separated, according to the common custom, when I was but an infant, and, of course, before I knew my mother from anyone else. The germs of affection with which the Almighty, in His wisdom and mercy, arms the hopeless infant against the ills and vicissitudes of his lot, had been directed in their growth toward that loving old grandmother, whose gentle hand and kind deportment it was in the first effort of my infantile understanding to comprehend and appreciate. Accordingly, the tenderest affection which a beneficent father allows, as a partial compensation to the mother for the pains and lacerations of her heart, incident to the maternal relation, was, in my case, diverted from its true and natural object, by the envious, greedy, and treacherous hand of slavery. The slave mother can be spared long enough from 41 my mother, the field to endure all the bitterness of a mother's anguish, when it adds another name to a master's ledger, but underscore not underscore long enough to receive the joyous reward afforded by the intelligent smiles of her child. I never think of this terrible interference of slavery with my infantile affections, and its diverting them from their natural course, without feelings to which I can give no adequate expression. I do not remember to have seen my mother at my grandmother's at any time. I remember her only in her visits to me at Colonel Lloyd's plantation, and in the kitchen of my old master. Her visits to me there were few in number, brief in duration, and mostly made in the night. The pains she took, and the toil she endured, to see me, tells me that a true mother's heart was hers, and that slavery had difficulty in paralyzing it with unmotherly indifference. My mother was hired out to a Mr. Stewart, who lived about 12 miles from old master's, and, being a field hand, she seldom had leisure, by day, for the performance of the journey. The nights and the distance were both obstacles to her visits. She was obliged to walk, unless chance flung into her way an opportunity to ride, and the latter was sometimes her good luck. But she always had to walk one way or the other. It was a greater luxury than slavery could afford, to allow a black slave mother a horse or a mule, upon which to travel 24 miles, when she could walk the distance. Besides, it is deemed a foolish whim for a slave mother to manifest concern to see her children, and, in one point of view, the case is made out she can do nothing for them. She has no control over them, the master is even more than the mother, in all matters touching the fate of her child. Why, then, should she give herself any concern? She has no responsibility. Such is the reasoning, and such the practice. The iron rule of the plantation, always passionately and violently enforced in that neighborhood, makes flogging the penalty of 42, failing to be in the field before sunrise in the morning, unless special permission be given to the absenting slave. I went to see my child, is no excuse to the ear or heart of the overseer. One of the visits of my mother to me, while at Colonel Lloyd's, I remember very vividly, as affording a bright gleam of a mother's love, and the earnestness of a mother's care. I had on that day offended Aunt Katie, called Aunt by way of respect, the cook of old master's establishment. I do not now remember the nature of my offense in this instance, for my offenses were numerous in that quarter, greatly depending, however, upon the mood of Aunt Katie, as to their heinousness, but she had adopted, that day, her favorite mode of punishing me, namely, making me go without food all day, that is, from after breakfast. The first hour or two after dinner, I succeeded pretty well in keeping up my spirits, but though I made an excellent stand against the foe, and fought bravely during the afternoon, I knew I must be conquered at last, unless I got the accustomed reinforcement of a slice of corn bread, at sundown. Sundown came, but underscore no bread underscore, and, in its stead, there came the threat, with a scowl well suited to its terrible import, that she meant to underscore starve the life out of me. Underscore brandishing her knife, She chopped off the heavy slices for the other children, and put the loaf away, muttering, all the while, her savage designs upon myself. Against this disappointment, for I was expecting that her heart would relent at last, I made an extra effort to maintain my dignity, but when I saw all the other children around me with merry and satisfied faces, I could stand it no longer. I went out behind the house, and cried like a fine fellow. When tired of this, I returned to the kitchen, sat by the fire, and brooded over my hard lot. I was too hungry to sleep. While I sat in the corner, I caught sight of an ear of Indian corn on an upper shelf of the kitchen. I watched my chance, and got it, and, shelling off a few grains, I put it back again. The grains in my hand, I quickly put in some ashes, and covered them with embers, to roast them. All this I 43, did at the risk of getting a brutal thumping, for Aunt Katie could beat, as well as starve me. My corn was not long in roasting, and, with my keen appetite, it did not matter even if the grains were not exactly done. I eagerly pulled them out, and placed them on my stool, in a clever little pile. Just as I began to help myself to my very dry meal, in came my dear mother. And now, dear reader, a scene occurred which was altogether worth beholding, and to me it was instructive as well as interesting. The friendless and hungry boy, in his extremest need and when he did not dare to look for succor, found himself in the strong, protecting arms of a mother who was, at the moment, being endowed with high powers of manner as well as matter, more than a match for all his enemies. I shall never forget the indescribable expression of her countenance, when I told her that I had had no food since morning, and that Aunt Katie said she meant to starve the life out of me. There was pity in her glance at me, and a fiery indignation at Aunt Katie at the same time, and, while she took the corn from me, and gave me a large ginger cake, in its stead, she read Aunt Katie a lecture which she never forgot. My mother threatened her with complaining to old master in my behalf, for the latter, though harsh and cruel himself, at times, did not sanction the meanness, injustice, partiality and oppressions enacted by Aunt Katie in the kitchen. That night I learned the fact, that I was, not only a child, but _somebody_s_child. The sweet cake my mother gave me was in the shape of a heart, with a rich, dark ring glazed upon the edge of it. I was victorious, and well off for the moment, prouder, on my mother's knee, than a king upon his throne. But my triumph was short. I dropped off to sleep, and waked in the morning only to find my mother gone, and myself left at the mercy of the sable virago, dominant in my old master's kitchen, whose fiery wrath was my constant dread. I do not remember to have seen my mother after this occurrence. Death soon ended the little communication that had 44, existed between us, and with it, I believe, a life judging from her weary, sad, downcast countenance and mute demeanor full of heartfelt sorrow. I was not allowed to visit her during any part of her long illness, nor did I see her for a long time before she was taken ill and died. The heartless and ghastly form of _slavery_ rises between mother and child, even at the bed of death. The mother, at the verge of the grave, may not gather her children, to impart to them her holy admonitions, and invoke for them her dying benediction. The bondwoman lives as a slave, and is left to die as a beast, often with fewer attentions than are paid to a favorite horse. Scenes of sacred tenderness, around the deathbed, never forgotten, and which often arrest the vicious and confirm the virtuous during life, must be looked for among the free, though they sometimes occur among the slaves. It has been a lifelong, standing grief to me, that I knew so little of my mother, and that I was so early separated from her. The counsels of her love must have been beneficial to me. The side view of her face is imaged on my memory, and I take few steps in life, without feeling her presence, but the image is mute, and I have no striking words of hers treasured up. I learned, after my mother's death, that she could read, and that she was the _only_one of all the slaves and colored people in Tuckahoe who enjoyed that advantage. How she acquired this knowledge, I know not, for Tuckahoe is the last place in the world where she would be apt to find facilities for learning. I can, therefore, fondly and proudly ascribe to her an earnest love of knowledge. That a field hand should learn to read, in any slave state, is remarkable, but the achievement of my mother, considering the place, was very extraordinary, and, in view of that fact, I am quite willing, and even happy, to attribute any love of letters I possess, and for which I have got despite of prejudices only too much credit, to my admitted Anglo-Saxon paternity, but to the native genius of my sable, unprotected, and uncultivated mother, a woman, who belonged to a race 45 penalty for having a white father, whose mental endowments it is, at present, fashionable to hold in disparagement and contempt. Summoned away to her account, With the impassable gulf of slavery between us during her entire illness, my mother died without leaving me a single intimation of underscore who underscore my father was. There was a whisper that my master was my father, yet it was only a whisper, and I cannot say that I ever gave it credence. Indeed, I now have reason to think he was not. Nevertheless, the fact remains, in all its glaring odiousness, that, by the laws of slavery, children, in all cases, are reduced to the condition of their mothers. This arrangement admits of the greatest license to brutal slaveholders, and their profligate sons, brothers, relations and friends, and gives to the pleasure of sin, the additional attraction of profit. A whole volume might be written on the single feature of slavery, as I have observed it. One might imagine, that the children of such connections, would fare better, in the hands of their masters, than other slaves. The rule is quite the other way, and a very little reflection will satisfy the reader that such is the case. A man who will enslave his own blood, may not be safely relied on for magnanimity. Men do not love those who remind them of their sins unless they have a mind to repent, and the mulatto child's face is a standing accusation against him who is master and father to the child. What is still worse, perhaps, such a child is a constant offense to the wife. She hates its very presence, and what a slaveholding woman hates, she wants not means to give that hate-telling effect. Women, white women, I mean, are idols at the South, not wives, for the slave women are preferred in many instances, and if these underscore idols underscore but nod, or lift a finger, woe to the poor victim, kicks, cuffs and stripes are sure to follow. Masters are frequently compelled to sell this class of their slaves, out of deference to the feelings of their white wives, and shocking and scandalous as it may seem for a man to sell his own blood to the traffickers in human flesh, it is often an act of humanity 46, toward the slave child to be thus removed from his merciless tormentors. It is not within the scope of the design of my simple story, to comment upon every phase of slavery not within my experience as a slave. But, I may remark, that, if the lineal descendants of Ham are only to be enslaved, according to the scriptures, slavery in this country will soon become an unscriptural institution, for thousands are ushered into the world, annually, who like myself owe their existence to white fathers, and, most frequently, to their masters, and masters' sons. The slave woman is at the mercy of the fathers, sons or brothers of her master. The thoughtful know the rest. After what I have now said of the circumstances of my mother, and my relations to her, the reader will not be surprised, nor be disposed to censure me, when I tell but the simple truth, viz., that I received the tidings of her death with no strong emotions of sorrow for her, and with very little regret for myself on account of her loss. I had to learn the value of my mother long after her death, and by witnessing the devotion of other mothers to their children. There is not, beneath the sky, an enemy to filial affection so destructive as slavery. It had made my brothers and sisters strangers to me, it converted the mother that bore me, into a myth, it shrouded my father in mystery, and left me without an intelligible beginning in the world. My mother died when I could not have been more than 8 or 9 years old, on one of old master's farms in Tuckahoe, in the neighborhood of Hillsboro. Her grave is, as the grave of the dead at sea, unmarked, and without stone or stake. Chapter 4. A General Survey of the Slave Plantation underscore. It is generally supposed that slavery, in the state of Maryland, exists in its mildest form, and that it is totally divested of those harsh and terrible peculiarities, which mark and characterize the slave system, in the southern and southwestern states of the American Union. The argument in favor of this opinion, is the contiguity of the free states, and the exposed condition of slavery in Maryland to the moral, religious and humane sentiment of the free states. I am not about to refute this argument, so far as it relates to slavery in that state, generally, on the contrary, I am willing to admit that, to this general point, the arguments is well grounded. Public opinion is, indeed, an unfailing restraint upon the cruelty and barbarity of masters, overseers, and slave drivers, whenever and wherever it can reach them, but there are certain secluded and out-of-the-way places, even in the state of Maryland, seldom visited by a single ray of healthy public sentiment where 48, slavery, wrapped in its own congenial, midnight darkness, underscore can underscore, and underscore does underscore, develop all its malign and shocking characteristics, where it can be indecent without shame, cruel without shuddering, and murderous without apprehension or fear of exposure. Just such a secluded, dark, and out-of-the-way place, is the home plantation of Colonel Edward Lloyd, on the eastern shore Maryland. It is far away from all the great thoroughfares, and is proximate to no town or village. There is neither schoolhouse, nor townhouse in its neighborhood. The schoolhouse is unnecessary, for there are no children to go to school. The children and grandchildren of Colonel Lloyd were taught in the house, by a private tutor, a Mr. Page, a tall, gaunt sapling of a man, who did not speak a dozen words to a slave in a whole year. The overseer's children go off somewhere to school, and they, therefore, bring no foreign or dangerous influence from abroad, to embarrass the natural operation of the slave system of the place. Not even the mechanics, through whom there is an occasional outburst of honest and telling indignation at cruelty and wrong on other plantations, are white men, on this plantation. Its whole public is made up of, and divided into, three classes: slaveholders, slaves and overseers. Its blacksmiths, wheelwrights, shoemakers, weavers, and coopers, are slaves. Not even commerce, selfish and iron-hearted as it is, and ready, as it ever is, to side with the strong against the weak, the rich against the poor, is trusted or permitted within its secluded precincts. Whether with a view of guarding against the escape of its secrets, I know not, but it is a fact, the every leaf and grain of the produce of this plantation, and those of the neighboring farms belonging to Colonel Lloyd, are transported to Baltimore in Colonel Lloyd's own vessels, every man and boy on board of which except the captain are owned by him. In return, everything brought to the plantation comes through the same channel. Thus, even the glimmering and unsteady light of trade, which sometimes exerts a civilizing influence, is excluded from this tabooed spot. 49. Nearly all the plantations or farms in the vicinity of the home plantation of Colonel Lloyd belong to him, and those which do not are owned by personal friends of his, as deeply interested in maintaining the slave system in all its rigor as Colonel Lloyd himself. Some of his neighbors are said to be even more stringent than he. The Skinners, the Peakers, the Tilgmans, the Lockermans, and the Gypsons are in the same boat, being slaveholding neighbors. They may have strengthened each other in their iron rule. They are on intimate terms, and their interests and tastes are identical. Public opinion in such a quarter, the reader will see, is not likely to vary efficient in protecting the slave from cruelty. On the contrary, it must increase and intensify his wrongs. Public opinion seldom differs very widely from public practice. To be a restraint upon cruelty and vice, public opinion must emanate from a humane and virtuous community. To no such humane and virtuous community is Colonel Lloyd's plantation exposed. That plantation is a little nation of its own, having its own language, its own rules, regulations and customs. The laws and institutions of the state apparently touch it nowhere. The troubles arising here are not settled by the civil power of the state. The overseer is generally accuser, judge, jury, advocate and executioner. The criminal is always dumb. The overseer attends to all sides of a case. There are no conflicting rights of property, for all the people are owned by one man, and they can themselves own no property. Religion and politics are alike excluded. One class of the population is too high to be reached by the preacher, and the other class is too low to be cared for by the preacher. The poor have the gospel preached to them, in this neighborhood, only when they are able to pay for it. The slaves, having no money, get no gospel. The politician keeps away, because the people have no votes, and the preacher keeps away, because the people have no money. The rich planter can afford to learn politics in the parlor, and to dispense with religion altogether. 50. In its isolation, seclusion, and self-reliant independence, Colonel Lloyd's plantation resembles what the baronial domains were during the Middle Ages in Europe. Grim, cold, and unapproachable by all genial influences from communities without, there it stands full 300 years behind the age, in all that relates to humanity and morals. This, however, is not the only view that the place presents. Civilization is shut out, but nature cannot be. Though separated from the rest of the world, though public opinion, as I have said, seldom gets a chance to penetrate its dark domain, though the whole place is stamped with its own peculiar, iron-like individuality, and though crimes, high-handed and atrocious, may there be committed, with almost as much impunity as upon the deck of a pirate ship it is, nevertheless, altogether, to outward seeming, a most strikingly interesting place, full of life, activity, and spirit, and presents a very favorable contrast to the indolent monotony and languor of Tuckahoe. Keen as was my regret and great as was my sorrow at leaving the latter, I was not long in adapting myself to this, my new home. A man's troubles are always half disposed of, when he finds endurance his only remedy. I found myself here, there was no getting away, and what remained for me, but to make the best of it. Here were plenty of children to play with, and plenty of places of pleasant resort for boys of my age, and boys older. The little tendrils of affection, so rudely and treacherously broken from around the darling objects of my grandmother's hut, gradually began to extend, and to entwine about the new objects by which I now found myself surrounded. There was a windmill, always a commanding object to a child's eye, on Long Point, a tract of land dividing Miles River from the Wye, a mile or more from my old master's house. There was a creek to swim in, at the bottom of an open flat space, of 20 acres or more, called the Long Green, a very beautiful playground for the children. 51. In the river, a short distance from the shore, lying quietly at anchor, with her small boat dancing at her stern, was a large sloop, the Sally Lloyd, called by that name in honor of a favorite daughter of the colonel. The sloop and the mill were wondrous things, full of thoughts and ideas. A child cannot well look at such objects without underscore thinking underscore. Then here were a great many houses, human habitations, full of the mysteries of life at every stage of it. There was the little red house, up the road, occupied by Mr. Sevier, the overseer. A little nearer to my old master's, stood a very long, rough, low building, literally alive with slaves, of all ages, conditions and sizes. This was called the Long Quarter. Perched upon a hill, across the Long Green, was a very tall, dilapidated, old brick building, the architectural dimensions of which proclaimed its erection for a different purpose now occupied by slaves, in a similar manner to the Long Quarter. Besides these, there were numerous other slave houses and huts, scattered around in the neighborhood, every nook and corner of which was completely occupied. Old Master's house, a long, brick building, plain, but substantial, stood in the center of the plantation life, and constituted one independent establishment on the premises of Colonel Lloyd. Besides these dwellings, there were barns, stables, storehouses, and tobacco houses, blacksmiths' shops, wheelwrights' shops, cooper's shops, all objects of interest, but, above all, there stood the grandest building my eyes have then ever beheld, called, by everyone on the plantation, the Great House. This was occupied by Colonel Lloyd and his family. They occupied it, underscore I underscore enjoyed it. The Great House was surrounded by numerous and variously shaped outbuildings. There were kitchens, washhouses, dairies, summer house, greenhouses, hen houses, turkey houses, pigeon houses, and arbors, of many sizes and devices, all neatly painted, and altogether interspersed with grand old trees, ornamental and primitive, which afforded delightful shade in 52, summer, and imparted to the scene a high degree of stately beauty. The Great House itself was a large, white, wooden building, with wings on three sides of it. In front, a large portico, extending the entire length of the building, and supported by a long range of columns, gave to the whole establishment an air of solemn grandeur. It was a treat to my young and gradually opening mind, to behold this elaborate exhibition of wealth, power, and vanity. The carriage entrance to the house was a large gate, more than a quarter of a mile distant from it. The intermediate space was a beautiful lawn, very neatly trimmed, and watched with the greatest care. It was dotted thickly over with delightful trees, shrubbery, and flowers. The road, or lane, from the gate to the Great House, was richly paved with white pebbles from the beach, and, in its course, formed a complete circle around the beautiful lawn. Carriages going in and retiring from the Great House, made the circuit of the lawn, and their passengers were permitted to behold a scene of almost Eden-like beauty. Outside this select enclosure, were parks, whereas about the residences of the English nobility rabbits, deer, and other wild game, might be seen, peering and playing about, with none to molest them or make them afraid. The tops of the stately poplars were often covered with the red-winged blackbirds, making all nature vocal with the joyous life and beauty of their wild, warbling notes. These all belonged to me, as well as to Colonel Edward Lloyd, and for a time I greatly enjoyed them. A short distance from the Great House, were the stately mansions of the dead, a place of somber aspect. Vast tombs, embowered beneath the weeping willow and the fir tree, told of the antiquities of the Lloyd family, as well as of their wealth. Superstition was rife among the slaves about this family burying ground. Strange sights had been seen there by some of the older slaves. Shrouded ghosts, riding on great black horses, had been seen to enter, balls of fire had been seen to fly there at midnight, and horrid sounds had been repeatedly heard. Slaves know 53, enough of the rudiments of theology to believe that those go to hell who die slaveholders, and they often fancy such persons wishing themselves back again, to wield the lash. Tales of sights and sounds, strange and terrible, connected with the huge black tombs, were a very great security to the grounds about them, for few of the slaves felt like approaching them even in the daytime. It was a dark, gloomy and forbidding place, and it was difficult to feel that the spirits of the sleeping dust there deposited, reigned with the blessed in the realms of eternal peace. The business of 20 or 30 farms was transacted at this, called, by way of eminence, Great House Farm. These farms all belonged to Colonel Lloyd, as did, also, the slaves upon them. Each farm was under the management of an overseer. As I have said of the overseer of the home plantation, so I may say of the overseers on the smaller ones, they stand between the slave and all civil constitutions. Their word is law, and is implicitly obeyed. The colonel, at this time, was reputed to be, and he apparently was, very rich. His slaves, alone, were an immense fortune. These, small and great, could not have been fewer than 1,000 in number, and though scarcely a month passed without the sale of one or more lots to the Georgia traders, there was no apparent diminution in the number of his human stock. The home plantation merely groaned at a removal of the young increase, or human crop, then proceeded as lively as ever. Horseshoeing, cart mending, plow repairing, coopering, grinding, and weaving, for all the neighboring farms, were performed here, and slaves were employed in all these branches. Uncle Tony was the blacksmith, Uncle Harry was the cartwright, Uncle Abel was the shoemaker, and all these had hands to assist them in their several departments. These mechanics were called uncles by all the younger slaves, not because they really sustained that relationship to any, but according to plantation underscore etiquette underscore, as a mark of respect, do 54, from the younger to the older slaves. Strange, and even ridiculous as it may seem, among a people so uncultivated, and with so many stern trials to look in the face, there is not to be found, among any people, a more rigid enforcement of the law of respect to elders, than they maintain. I set this down as partly constitutional with my race, and partly conventional. There is no better material in the world for making a gentleman, than is furnished in the African. He shows to others, and exacts for himself, all the tokens of respect which he is compelled to manifest toward his master. A young slave must approach the company of the older with hat in hand, and woe betide him, if he fails to acknowledge a favor, of any sort, with the accustomed underscore tanky, underscore and C. So uniformly are good manners enforced among slaves, I can easily detect a bogus fugitive by his manners. Among other slave notabilities of the plantation, was one called by everybody Uncle Isaac Copper. It is seldom that a slave gets a surname from anybody in Maryland, and so completely has the South shaped the manners of the North, in this respect, that even abolitionists make very little of the surname of a Negro. The only improvement on the Bills, Jacks, Jims, and Neds of the South, observable here is, that William, John, James, Edward, are substituted. It goes against the grain to treat and address a Negro precisely as they would treat and address a white man. But, once in a while, in slavery as in the free states, by some extraordinary circumstance, the Negro has a surname fastened to him, and holds it against all conventionalities. This was the case with Uncle Isaac Copper. When the uncle was dropped, he generally had the prefix doctor, in its stead. He was our doctor of medicine, and doctor of divinity as well. Where he took his degree I am unable to say, for he was not very communicative to inferiors, and I was emphatically such, being but a boy 7 or 8 years old. He was too well established in his profession to permit questions as to his native skill, or his attainments. One qualification he undoubtedly had, E55 praying and flogging, was a confirmed underscore cripple semicolon underscore, and he could neither work, nor would he bring anything if offered for sale in the market. The old man, though lame, was no sluggard. He was a man that made his crutches do him good service. He was always on the alert, looking up the sick, and all such as were supposed to need his counsel. His remedial prescriptions embraced 4 articles. For diseases of the body, underscore Epsom salts and castor oil semicolon underscore for those of the soul, underscore the Lord's Prayer underscore, and underscore hickory switches underscore. I was not long at Colonel Lloyd's before I was placed under the care of Dr. Isaac Copper. I was sent to him with 20 or 30 other children, to learn the Lord's Prayer. I found the old gentleman seated on a huge 3-legged oaken stool, armed with several large hickory switches, and, from his position, he could reach lame as he was any boy in the room. After standing a while to learn what was expected of us, the old gentleman, in any other than a devotional tone, commanded us to kneel down. This done, he commenced telling us to say everything he said. Our Father, this was repeated after him with promptness and uniformity, who art in heaven was less promptly and uniformly repeated, and the old gentleman paused in the prayer, to give us a short lecture upon the consequences of inattention, both immediate and future, and especially those more immediate. About these he was absolutely certain, for he held in his right hand the means of bringing all his predictions and warnings to pass. On he proceeded with the prayer, and we with our thick tongues and unskilled ears, followed him to the best of our ability. This, however, was not sufficient to please the old gentleman. Everybody, in the South, wants the privilege of whipping somebody else. Uncle Isaac shared the common passion of his country, and, therefore, seldom found any means of keeping his disciples in order short of flogging. Say everything I say, and bang would come the switch on some poor boy's undevotional head. Underscore what you looking at there, stop that pushing underscore and down again would come the lash. 56. The whip is all in all. It is supposed to secure obedience to the slaveholder, and is held as a sovereign remedy among the slaves themselves, for every form of disobedience, temporal or spiritual. Slaves, as well as slaveholders, use it with an unsparing hand. Our devotions at Uncle Isaac's combine too much of the tragic and comic, to make them very salutary in a spiritual point of view, and it is due to truth to say, I was often a truant when the time for attending the praying and flogging of Dr. Isaac Copper came on. The windmill under the care of Mr. Kinney, a kind-hearted old Englishman, was to me a source of infinite interest and pleasure. The old man always seemed pleased when he saw a troop of darky little urchins, with their tow linen shirts fluttering in the breeze, approaching to view and admire the whirling wings of his wondrous machine. From the mill we could see other objects of deep interest. These were, the vessels from St. Michael's, on their way to Baltimore. It was a source of much amusement to view the flowing sails and complicated rigging, as the little craft dashed by, and to speculate upon Baltimore, as to the kind and quality of the place. With so many sources of interest around me, the reader may be prepared to learn that I began to think very highly of Colonel L.'s plantation. It was just a place to my boyish taste. There were fish to be caught in the creek, if one only had a hook and line, and crabs, clams and oysters were to be caught by wading, digging and raking for them. Here was a field for industry and enterprise, strongly inviting, and the reader may be assured that I entered upon it with spirit. Even the much dreaded old master, whose merciless fiat had brought me from Tuckahoe, gradually, to my mind, parted with his terrors. Strange enough, his reverence seemed to take no particular notice of me, nor of my coming. Instead of leaping out and devouring me, he scarcely seemed conscious of my presence. The fact is, he was occupied with matters more weighty and important than either looking after or vexing me. He probably thought his 57 old master losing its terrors, little of my advent, as he would have thought of the addition of a single pig to his stock. As the chief butler on Colonel Lloyd's plantation, his duties were numerous and perplexing. In almost all important matters he answered in Colonel Lloyd's stead. The overseers of all the farms were in some sort under him, and received the law from his mouth. The colonel himself seldom addressed an overseer, or allowed an overseer to address him. Old master carried the keys of all storehouses, measured out the allowance for each slave at the end of every month, superintended the storing of all goods brought to the plantation, dealt out the raw material to all the handicraftsmen, shipped the grain, tobacco, and all saleable produce of the plantation to market, and had the general oversight of the cooper's shop, wheelwright's shop, blacksmith's shop, and shoemaker's shop. Besides the care of these, he often had business for the plantation which required him to be absent 2 and 3 days. Thus largely employed, he had little time, and perhaps as little disposition, to interfere with the children individually. What he was to Colonel Lloyd, he made Aunt Katie to him. When he had anything to say or do about us, it was said or done in a wholesale manner, disposing of us in classes or sizes, leaving all minor details to Aunt Katie, a person of whom the reader has already received no very favorable impression. Aunt Katie was a woman who never allowed herself to act greatly within the margin of power granted to her, no matter how broad that authority might be. Ambitious, ill-tempered and cruel, she found in her present position an ample field for the exercise of her ill-omened qualities. She had a strong hold on old masters. She was considered a first-rate cook, and she really was very industrious. She was, therefore, greatly favored by old master, and as one mark of his favor, she was the only mother who was permitted to retain her children around her. Even to these children she was often fiendish in her brutality. She pursued her son Phil, one day, in 58, my presence, with a huge butcher knife, and dealt a blow with its edge which left a shocking gash on his arm, near the wrist. For this, old master did sharply rebuke her, and threatened that if she ever should do the like again, he would take the skin off her back. Cruel, however, as Aunt Katie was to her own children, at times she was not destitute of maternal feeling, as I often had occasion to know, in the bitter pinches of hunger I had to endure. Differing from the practice of Colonel Lloyd, old master, instead of allowing so much for each slave, committed the allowance for all to the care of Aunt Katie, to be divided after cooking it, amongst us. The allowance, consisting of coarse cornmeal, was not very abundant indeed, it was very slender, and in passing through Aunt Katie's hands, it was made more slender still, for some of us. William, Phil and Jerry were her children, and it is not to accuse her too severely, to allege that she was often guilty of starving myself and the other children, while she was literally cramming her own. One of food was my chief trouble the first summer at my old master's. Oysters and clams would do very well, with an occasional supply of bread, but they soon failed in the absence of bread. I speak but the simple truth, when I say, I have often been so pinched with hunger, that I have fought with the dog old net for the smallest crumbs that fell from the kitchen table, and have been glad when I won a single crumb in the combat. Many times have I followed, with eager step, the waiting girl when she went out to shake the tablecloth, to get the crumbs and small bones flung out for the cats. The water, in which meat had been boiled, was as eagerly sought for by me. It was a great thing to get the privilege of dipping a piece of bread in such water, and the skin taken from rusty bacon, was a positive luxury. Nevertheless, I sometimes got full meals and kind words from sympathizing old slaves, who knew my sufferings, and received the comforting assurance that I should be a man someday. Never mind, honey, better day coming, was even then a solace, a cheering consolation to me in my 59 troubles. Nor were all the kind words I received from slaves. I had a friend in the parlor, as well, and one to whom I shall be glad to do justice, before I have finished this part of my story. I was not long at old master's, before I learned that his surname was Anthony, and that he was generally called Captain Anthony, a title which he probably acquired by sailing a craft in the Chesapeake Bay. Colonel Lloyd's slaves never called Captain Anthony old master, but always Captain Anthony, and __me__ they called Captain Anthony Fred. There is not, probably, in the whole South, a plantation where the English language is more imperfectly spoken than on Colonel Lloyd's. It is a mixture of Guinea and everything else you please. At the time of which I am now writing, there were slaves there who had been brought from the coast of Africa. They never used the S in indication of a possessive case. Captain Anthony Tom, Lloyd Bill, Aunt Rose Harry, means Captain Anthony's Tom, Lloyd's Bill, and C. _ who you dem long to? _ means, whom do you belong to? _ who dem got any peachy? _ means, have you got any peaches? I could scarcely understand them when I first went among them, so broken was their speech, and I am persuaded that I could not have been dropped anywhere on the globe, where I could reap less, in the way of knowledge, from my immediate associates, than on this plantation. Even Moss Daniel, by his association with his father's slaves, had measurably adopted their dialect and their ideas, so far as they had ideas to be adopted. The equality of nature is strongly asserted in childhood, and childhood requires children for associates. _ color _ makes no difference with a child. Are you a child with wants, tastes and pursuits common to children, not put on, but natural? Then, were you black as ebony, you would be welcome to the child of alabaster whiteness. The law of compensation holds here, as well as elsewhere. Moss Daniel could not associate with ignorance without sharing its shade, and he could not give his black playmates his company, without giving them his intelligence, as well. Without knowing 60, this, or caring about it, at the time, I, for some cause or other, spent much of my time with Moss Daniel, in preference to spending it with most of the other boys. Moss Daniel was the youngest son of Colonel Lloyd. His older brothers were Edward and Murray, both grown up, and fine-looking men. Edward was especially esteemed by the children, and by me among the rest, not that he ever said anything to us or for us, which could be called especially kind. It was enough for us, that he never looked nor acted scornfully toward us. There were also three sisters, all married, one to Edward Winder, a second to Edward Nicholson, a third to Mr. Lones. The family of old master consisted of two sons, Andrew and Richard, his daughter, Lucretia, and her newly married husband, Captain Auld. This was the house family. The kitchen family consisted of Aunt Katie, Aunt Esther, and 10 or 12 children, most of them older than myself. Captain Anthony was not considered a rich slaveholder, but was pretty well off in the world. He owned about 30 head_ of slaves, and 3 farms in Tuckahoe. The most valuable part of his property was his slaves, of whom he could afford to sell one every year. This crop, therefore, brought him $700 or $800 a year, besides his yearly salary, and other revenue from his farms. The idea of rank and station was rigidly maintained on Colonel Lloyd's plantation. Our family never visited the great house, and the Lloyds never came to our home. Equal non-intercourse was observed between Captain Anthony's family and that of Mr. Sevier, the overseer. Such, kind reader, was the community, and such the place, in which my earliest and most lasting impressions of slavery, and of slave life, were received, of which impressions you will learn more in the coming chapters of this book. Chapter 5. _ Gradual initiation to the mysteries of slavery _ Although my old master Captain Anthony gave me at first, as the reader will have already seen, very little attention, And although that little was of a remarkably mild and gentle description, a few months only were sufficient to convince me that mildness and gentleness were not the prevailing or governing traits of his character. These excellent qualities were displayed only occasionally. He could, when it suited him, appear to be literally insensible to the claims of humanity, when appealed to by the helpless against an aggressor, and he could himself commit outrages, deep, dark and nameless. Yet he was not by nature worse than other men. Had he been brought up in a free state, surrounded by the just restraints of free society, restraints which are necessary to the freedom of all its members, alike and equally Captain Anthony might have been as humane a man, and every way as respectable, as many who now oppose the slave system, certainly as humane and respectable as are members of society generally. The slaveholder, as well as the slave, is the victim of the slave 62 system. A man's character greatly takes its hue and shape from the form and color of things about him. Under the whole heavens there is no relation more unfavorable to the development of honorable character than that sustained by the slaveholder to the slave. Reason is imprisoned here, and passions run wild. Like the fires of the prairie, once lighted, they are at the mercy of every wind, and must burn, till they have consumed all that is combustible within their remorseless grasp. Captain Anthony could be kind, and, at times, he even showed an affectionate disposition. Could the reader have seen him gently leading me by the hand as he sometimes did, patting me on the head, speaking to me in soft, caressing tones and calling me his little Indian boy, he would have deemed him a kind old man, and really, almost fatherly. But the pleasant moods of a slaveholder are remarkably brittle, they are easily snapped, they neither come often, nor remain long. His temper is subjected to perpetual trials, but, since these trials are never borne patiently, they add nothing to his natural stock of patience. Old Master very early impressed me with the idea that he was an unhappy man. Even to my child's eye, he wore a troubled, and at times, a haggard aspect. His strange movements excited my curiosity, and awakened my compassion. He seldom walked alone without muttering to himself, and he occasionally stormed about, as if defying an army of invisible foes. He would do this, that, and the other, he'd be DD if he did not, was the usual form of his threats. Most of his leisure was spent in walking, cursing and gesticulating, like one possessed by a demon. Most evidently, he was a wretched man, at war with his own soul, and with all the world around him. To be overheard by the children, disturbed him very little. He made no more of our presence, than of that of the ducks and geese which he met on the green. He little thought that the little black urchins around him, could see, through those vocal crevices, the very secrets of his heart. Slaveholders ever underrate the intelligence with which 63 supposed obtuseness of slave children, they have to grapple. I really understood the old man's mutterings, attitudes and gestures, about as well as he did himself. But slaveholders never encouraged that kind of communication, with the slaves, by which they might learn to measure the depths of his knowledge. Ignorance is a high virtue in a human chattel, and as the master studies to keep the slave ignorant, the slave is cunning enough to make the master think he succeeds. The slave fully appreciates the saying, "Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise." When old master's gestures were violent, ending with a threatening shake of the head, and a sharp snap of his middle finger and thumb, I deemed it wise to keep at a respectable distance from him, for, at such times, trifling faults stood, in his eyes, as momentous offenses, and, having both the power and the disposition, the victim had only to be near him to catch the punishment, deserved or undeserved. One of the first circumstances that opened my eyes to the cruelty and wickedness of slavery, and the heartlessness of my old master, was the refusal of the latter to interpose his authority, to protect and shield a young woman, who had been most cruelly abused and beaten by his overseer in Tuckahoe. This overseer, a Mr. Plummer, was a man like most of his class, little better than a human brute, and, in addition to his general profligacy and repulsive coarseness, the creature was a miserable drunkard. He was, probably, employed by my old master, less on account of the excellence of his services, than for the cheap rate at which they could be obtained. He was not fit to have the management of a drove of mules. In a fit of drunken madness, he committed the outrage which brought the young woman in question down to my old master's for protection. This young woman was the daughter of Millie, a known aunt of mine. The poor girl, on arriving at our house, presented a pitiable appearance. She had left in haste, and without preparation, and, probably, without the knowledge of Mr. Plummer. She had traveled 12 miles, barefooted, bare-necked and bare-headed. Her neck and shoulders 64, were covered with scars, newly made, and not content with marring her neck and shoulders, with the cowhide, the cowardly brute had dealt her a blow on the head with a hickory club, which cut a horrible gash, and left her face literally covered with blood. In this condition, the poor young woman came down, to implore protection at the hands of my old master. I expected to see him boil over with rage at the revolting deed, and to hear him fill the air with curses upon the brutal plumber, but I was disappointed. He sternly told her, in an angry tone, he believed she deserved every bit of it, and, if she did not go home instantly, he would himself take the remaining skin from her neck and back. Thus was the poor girl compelled to return, without redress, and perhaps to receive an additional flogging for daring to appeal to old master against the overseer. Old master seemed furious at the thought of being troubled by such complaints. I did not, at that time, understand the philosophy of his treatment of my cousin. It was stern, unnatural, violent. Had the man no bowels of compassion? Was he dead to all sense of humanity? No. I think I now understand it. This treatment is a part of the system, rather than a part of the man. Were slaveholders to listen to complaints of this sort against the overseers, the luxury of owning large numbers of slaves would be impossible. It would do away with the office of overseer, entirely, or, in other words, it would convert the master himself into an overseer. It would occasion great loss of time and labor, leaving the overseer in fetters, and without the necessary power to secure obedience to his orders. A privilege so dangerous as that of appeal is, therefore, strictly prohibited, and anyone exercising it runs a fearful hazard. Nevertheless, when a slave has nerve enough to exercise it, and boldly approaches his master, with a well-founded complaint against an overseer, though he may be repulsed, and may even have that of which he complains repeated at the time, and, though he may be beaten by his master, as well as by the overseer, for his temerity, in the end the 65, policy of complaining is, generally, vindicated by the relaxed rigor of the overseer's treatment. The latter becomes more careful, and less disposed to use the lash upon such slaves thereafter. It is with this final result in view, rather than with any expectation of immediate good, that the outraged slave is induced to meet his master with a complaint. The overseer very naturally dislikes to have the ear of the master disturbed by complaints, and, either upon this consideration, or upon advice and warning privately given him by his employers, he generally modifies the rigor of his rule, after an outbreak of the kind to which I have been referring. Howsoever the slaveholder may allow himself to act toward his slave, and, whatever cruelty he may deem it wise, for example's sake, or for the gratification of his humor, to inflict, he cannot, in the absence of all provocation, look with pleasure upon the bleeding wounds of a defenseless slave woman. When he drives her from his presence without redress, or the hope of redress, he acts, generally, from motives of policy, rather than from a hardened nature, or from innate brutality. Yet, let but his own temper be stirred, his own passions get loose, and the slave owner will go underscore far beyond underscore the overseer in cruelty. He will convince the slave that his wrath is far more terrible and boundless, and vastly more to be dreaded, than that of the underling overseer. What may have been mechanically and heartlessly done by the overseer, is now done with a will. The man who now wields the lash is irresponsible. He may, if he pleases, cripple or kill, without fear of consequences, except in so far as it may concern profit or loss. To a man of violent temper as my old master was but a very slender and inefficient restraint. I have seen him in a tempest of passion, such as I have just described, a passion into which entered all the bitter ingredients of pride, hatred, envy, jealousy, and the thirst sick for revenge. The circumstances which I am about to narrate, and which gave rise to this fearful tempest of passion, are not singular nor 66, isolated in slave life, but are common in every slaveholding community in which I have lived. They are incidental to the relation of master and slave, and exist in all sections of slaveholding countries. The reader will have noticed that, in enumerating the names of the slaves who lived with my old master, underscore Esther underscore is mentioned. This was a young woman who possessed that which is ever a curse to the slave girl, namely personal beauty. She was tall, well-formed, and made a fine appearance. The daughters of Colonel Lloyd could scarcely surpass her in personal charms. Esther was courted by Ned Roberts, and he was as fine-looking a young man as she was a woman. He was the son of a favorite slave of Colonel Lloyd. Some slaveholders would have been glad to promote the marriage of two such persons, but, for some reason or other, my old master took it upon him to break up the growing intimacy between Esther and Edward. He strictly ordered her to quit the company of said Roberts, telling her that he would punish her severely if he ever found her again in Edward's company. This unnatural and heartless order was, of course, broken. A woman's love is not to be annihilated by the peremptory command of anyone whose breath is in his nostrils. It was impossible to keep Edward and Esther apart. Meet they would, and meet they did. Had old master been a man of honor and purity, his motives, in this matter, might have been viewed more favorably. As it was, his motives were as abhorrent, as his methods were foolish and contemptible. It was too evident that he was not concerned for the girl's welfare. It is one of the damning characteristics of the slave system, that it robs its victims of every earthly incentive to a holy life. The fear of God, and the hope of heaven, are found sufficient to sustain many slave women, amidst the snares and dangers of their strange lot, but, this side of God and heaven, a slave woman is at the mercy of the power, caprice and passion of her owner. Slavery provides no means for the honorable continuance of the race. Marriage as imposing obligations on the parties to it has no 67 a harrowing scene, existence here, except in such hearts as are purer and higher than the standard morality around them. It is one of the consolations of my life, that I know of many honorable instances of persons who maintained their honor, where all around was corrupt. Esther was evidently much attached to Edward, and abhorred as she had reason to do the tyrannical and base behavior of old master. Edward was young, and fine-looking, and he loved and courted her. He might have been her husband, in the high sense just alluded to, but what was this old master? His attentions were plainly brutal and selfish, and it was as natural that Esther should loathe him, as that she should love Edward. Abhorred and circumvented as he was, old master, having the power, very easily took revenge. I happened to see this exhibition of his rage and cruelty toward Esther. The time selected was singular. It was early in the morning, when all besides was still, and before any of the family, in the house or kitchen, had left their beds. I saw but few of the shocking preliminaries, for the cruel work had begun before I awoke. I was probably awakened by the shrieks and piteous cries of poor Esther. My sleeping place was on the floor of a little, rough closet, which opened into the kitchen, and through the cracks of its unplaned boards, I could distinctly see and hear what was going on, without being seen by old master. Esther's wrists were firmly tied, and the twisted rope was fastened to a strong staple in a heavy wooden joist above, near the fireplace. Here she stood, on a bench, her arms tightly drawn over her breast. Her back and shoulders were bare to the waist. Behind her stood old master, with cowskin in hand, preparing his barbarous work with all manner of harsh, coarse, and tantalizing epithets. The screams of his victim were most piercing. He was cruelly deliberate, and protracted the torture, as one who was delighted with the scene. Again and again he drew the hateful whip through his hand, adjusting it with a view of dealing the most pain-giving blow. Poor Esther had never yet been severely whipped, and her shoulders 68, were plump and tender. Each blow, vigorously laid on, brought screams as well as blood. Have mercy, oh! Have mercy she cried, I won't do so no more, but her piercing cries seemed only to increase his fury. His answers to them are too coarse and blasphemous to be produced here. The whole scene, with all its attendants, was revolting and shocking, to the last degree, and when the motives of this brutal castigation are considered, language has no power to convey a just sense of its awful criminality. After laying on some 30 or 40 stripes, old master untied his suffering victim, and let her get down. She could scarcely stand, when untied. From my heart I pitied her, and child though I was, the outrage kindled in me a feeling far from peaceful, but I was hushed, terrified, stunned, and could do nothing, and the fate of Esther might be mine next. The scene here described was often repeated in the case of poor Esther, and her life, as I knew it, was one of wretchedness. Chapter 6. Treatment of slaves on Lloyd's plantation. The heartrending incidents, related in the foregoing chapter, led me, thus early, to inquire into the nature and history of slavery. Why am I a slave? Why are some people slaves, and others masters? Was there ever a time this was not so? How did the relation commence? These were the perplexing questions which began now to claim my thoughts, and to exercise the weak powers of my mind, for I was still but a child, and knew less than children of the same age in the free states. As my questions concerning these things were only put to children a little older, and little better informed than myself, I was not rapid in reaching a solid footing. By some means I learned from these inquiries that God, up in the sky, made everybody, and that he made white people to be masters and mistresses, and black people to be slaves. This did not satisfy me, nor lessen my interest in the subject. I was told, too, that God was good, and that he knew what was best for me, and best for everybody. This was less satisfactory than the first statement, because it came,